Merkle Media.
Hey everybody, welcome to Back It Up with Hammerlane Legends. This is Jack Merkle. I'm here to wind back the clock for you all, as I always do for the Back It Up episodes. But first, I'd like to say thank you to all of our veterans and those who have given their time and their lives to serve us, to keep us safe and provide the freedom and liberty we have in this country. It's definitely something that I think gets lost on us at times, but as we are coming up on beautiful, what it looks like, supposed to be a beautiful weekend here in the Northeast, we forget that we're actually supposed to be remembering those who have given their lives for this country, for the freedom and liberty that they've provided for us and for other countries as well. And it's just if you know anybody in your family, any dads, grandfathers, uncles, moms, grandmothers, whoever it is in your family or friends that may have served, spent time and dedicated their lives to protecting us, I'd invite you to give them a call or get in touch with them and just thank them for what they've done. It's a sacrifice of a lot of things. It's funny because in our family, we've had two people who have served in the Navy, my uncle and my grandfather. And it's something that it does take a lot out of you. Just from the experiences and the time that we've, obviously spent in conversation, and the short time that I was able to get to know my grandfather, and just be able to hear, what the Navy and his time in service had done for him, the character it helped build, and just the selflessness that you kind of have to be able to go into something to serve, and have a desire for something that's greater than yourself, to protect and to serve and to give us, sort of the freedoms, obviously, that we're given today. But it was really, it's something that's just, it's an incredible thing to see in someone. Even my friends from school, you see some, the knuckleheads that you grew up with, and they end up going into the military or into, the army or something. And they come out these buttoned up men, and now everybody's still goofballs, but there's a certain sense of respect and dignity that you come out with. And I saw that, obviously as a kid with my grandfather, hearing some stories that he shared with us, but not many. But you understand that there's just a way that you become a man or woman, when you come out of your service. And, I wish I would have had more time to be able to get to spend with my grandfather and be able to hear the stories that he may have had or the experiences he was able to see while he served. And that's why I say just take the time to spend with, in conversation with those who who have spent either their lives or who have spent some time in service. It's extremely difficult, I think, for a lot of people who've served. And I know that when we reach out to them just to thank them, however close we are to them, no matter who they are, I can't imagine that they wouldn't appreciate it. And again, I just wanted to say thank you to all who have served and who have given their lives, and to the families of those who have given their lives as well. It's a true selfless act, and it's really cool. for lack of better words. And, you know, now we basically get to the point of the show where I'm done rambling and we get into the actual show. This was episode 19. Episode 19, British Trucker versus Taliban. So obviously it's an early episode, but it was a fun one. I know the guys liked it. But this was with Dave, who is a former British member of the military. I'm sorry, a former member of the British military. He's still British. but yeah, he was in Afghanistan for some time, so there was a lot to it. And he definitely had some really good stories to share. And I mean, when you have that kind of experience and you're driving through what I would consider hell or even close to it, it's, you know, there's so much that comes out of it. Experience, not just in life and not just in who you are, but the people that shape you around you, and that help to keep you safe and that you help to keep safe. It's a lot. It's so much. It's more than what I would ever know and that a lot of us would know. But again, this is a pretty dope episode. I hope you guys enjoy this flashback, and you know, we'll get to it next week. We hope you guys have a great weekend. Enjoy your Memorial Day. And thanks again to all of our veterans who rock. All right. Peace out.
He put it in park, threw open the driver's door, ran out the side of the car, across the front of it, and jumped right off the side of the bridge in front of me.
The only people that really pulled over were truckers.
He said, "We're going to Hodge," and he didn't slow down. He went across the median onto the oncoming traffic, but where they could see him coming, they just got out of the way.
I noticed his plane was really low. He went right in front of us, hit the fence, and it spun around. You know, 30 seconds more, he could have hit us.
And I went around that truck, and a guy stepped out from behind the truck and threw a piece of wood, and it shot through my window just like a spear and stuck in the back of the cab of my truck.
That's probably one of the stranger things I've seen.
Welcome to the show, everybody. You're listening to Hammer Lane Legends. I am your host, Tony Merkel.
And I'm Brian Merkel.
And we're really glad that you're here. If you have a wild and crazy story you'd like to share with us from the road, go ahead and shoot us an email. Our email address is hammerlanelegends@gmail.com. That's hammerlanelegends@gmail.com. Or go to the website, hammerlanelegends.com, hit the contact section, and you can reach us that way as well. Either way works for us, just get a hold of us. We really enjoy hearing these stories, Dad. You and I just got done doing two really good interviews that people are going to hear later down the road. But today we have David coming on, or I should say Dave. I think his name is Dave.
Yeah.
And he came on to talk about his experiences driving overseas. And what did you take away from his experience the most? I mean, when you talk to him and the stories that he shared, the conversation went in a direction that I didn't expect it to go. But if you could kind of sum it up into like one or two sentences, what would you say you took away most from that conversation?
You know what? His stories were interesting, but it was the redemption factor. You know, we all make mistakes, and he was a soldier for the British,
yeah,
in Afghanistan, and just how war has that effect on people, and it can drag you down into doing something in things that you would not normally do,
yeah,
and that. But there is redemption. At the same time, there's redemption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to be that person when you come back to civilian life. You don't even have to be that person there. It just depends on how you how you allow it to affect you. You know, that is my takeaway. And that when you're fighting monsters, like Nietzsche said, you have to make sure you don't become a monster yourself.
Absolutely.
And I think we've seen that in our own society here.
Yeah.
You know, with what's going on right now.
Yeah. And that's really well said. More than two sentences, but it was really well said.
It was.
No, if I'm playing with you,
I don't just count well.
I'm just busting your
yeah. I know what you're busting.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think you're absolutely right, and I think it was a really good conversation, and the redemption factor is absolutely there.
Yeah.
And I think people are going to hopefully hear that. Going into the interview, I remember the first time him and I talked. I mean, this was the third time we tried getting this interview done. He told me that he wasn't proud of the things that happened over there. And I kind of forgot about that when we sat down and talked to him about this time around. And you'll hear me during the interview about halfway through reference that right. Sounds like you've handled this pretty well and this, that, and the other. And he's like, well, we haven't gotten to the dark stuff yet. And then yeah. We got to the dark stuff. And it was really interesting. I was really glad that he was able to share it and get it off his chest.
Most definitely.
I think he was too. And I think there's a lot to learn inside this interview as far as understanding that life happens to you. And when life happens, sometimes you find yourself being somebody you never could have dreamed of being. And the redemption is you can always backtrack and you can always change it.
Yes.
You can always go back to what you used to be or become somebody you've never been before.
Yeah.
Control that change. So without any further delay, let's get to Dave right now. All right, today we got a great guest coming on. We have Dave. Dave, how you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm doing really well. How are you guys?
We're doing good.
We're doing real well. It's good to talk to you.
So, Dave, you're over in the UK, and you drove for the military. You have some pretty interesting stories that you want to share with us today. Is that right?
Yeah, this is correct.
So, let's start off with, when did you drive for the military? And just kind of walk us into some of these experiences driving for the military. I know you were overseas and stuff during, I think it was Afghan, right?
Yeah, Afghanistan, yeah.
Yeah, so walk us into some of these situations. How'd you get involved in the military? How'd you wind up driving for the military?
I got in the military at 16 because there was no jobs, not a lot of jobs in London that I wanted to do. So I joined up, and lo and behold, driving truck was part of it. So basically at 17, I had all my licenses to drive anything up to 90 foot articulated, everything. So it was like you go to driving training center and then learn to drive, obviously, cars first, then cars with trailer. Then you're over 3.5 ton, and then all the big stuff. And yeah, by the time I was 17, I had all my licenses. It's about, in the UK, it's probably about $15,000 worth at the time.
Is that something normal over there in the UK to have all those kind of licenses early at that age? I mean, because here in the States, I mean, they talk about possibly moving the age to even be allowed to drive a vehicle, like a car, to 18.
Not driving truck, but when I was in the military, a lot of the guys were young, like half of them be under 20 driving truck in the military. In civilian life, it's a little bit different. You can't get insured on a truck till you're 25. So obviously you couldn't get out the military, you know, and start driving truck because companies wouldn't insure you unless you're over 25.
That's really interesting. I mean, when you say that around half of the people driving truck were under 20, I'm sitting here thinking, my goodness, like, is that a good idea? I don't know. I mean, I would think that you'd want somebody that has a lot of experience driving to be driving, but I guess, you know, I'm wrong. So,
well, it seems to me that in the military, it's a different life anyway. It's a different situation. So, you know, they're taking what is coming along and they're using those people. And usually military people start their career as a younger person. So I would imagine that, yeah, 16 is a little young. Yeah, having all your licenses by the time you're 17 is amazing. So that's my hats off to you, dude. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was fun, you know. It was good experience very early on. And trust me, there was a lot of crashes because we do the civilian training and then every truck that's from the military or every vehicle that's from the military have to do extra training on that. So we crashed a lot. We broke a lot of axles and yeah, we messed up a lot of stuff. So it's great fun.
Yeah, I can imagine that. But like I said, it's still awesome. You know, at such a young age to be in charge of something that big. I mean, I can't imagine myself when I was 16 learning how to drive a car, learning how to drive a truck at the same time. You know, here in the States, you know, 16 is for the most part the age that kids learn to drive cars, but they don't learn how to drive trucks. So that's actually really kind of cool.
Yeah.
So you're over there and you get these licenses and you start driving, and what happens, man? I mean, what kind of situations have you found yourself in that maybe you wish you weren't in, or what was it like? I mean, driving over there.
Oh, in Afghanistan, it's a similar like driving experience. There's a lot of mud in the winter. I've done two winter tours, so it was a lot of mud. And then when it gets hot, there's a lot of dust, and yeah, most of the time in the dust you can't see and stuff like that. But it was a very different driving experience. But before then I'd driven a lot of places anywhere over the UK and Norway as well. So it was, you know, it wasn't too difficult for me, but you know, it was still very challenging. We started off when we flew out. When you fly out to Afghanistan, you land in Kandahar, and then you get a nighttime Hercules over to Camp Bastion. And your first 2 weeks are learning the trucks and learning the guns. The guns is the main thing, because we don't have, in the UK, we don't have a lot of the guns that they have in Afghanistan at the time. So like the 50 cal, I think we only had two in the UK at that time. So we would train on it, but it would be like literally a day and that would be it. So once you get to Afghanistan, you get to shoot all the guns because they're out there. The grenade machine guns out there, they didn't have them in the UK. So first 2 weeks was firing in, get used to the trucks, get your truck set up, get the guns mounted on the truck, get handover as well. Handover is very important because literally week by week, the SOPs can change, especially if you go to a different location or a new location, everything can change. So we were operating out at Camp Bastion, and I remember it was like week one in Camp Bastion, and we all go into the hangar, the main hangar where our squadron was, and there's about 30 of us walking down the road in Camp Bastion. It's probably the safest place ever. Well, that's what I thought, you know. And it's massive town. It's a massive town, and we're walking down the road, we just hear a massive whistle coming in. So me and these 30 guys are walking down the road. We hear this whistling like crazy. We're thinking, where's this coming from? So obviously it's night time. We couldn't see anything, and we're looking up, and then we hear whistling. It's getting louder and louder and louder. It sounds like a rocket. So we all start diving. We all dive in the side of the road where they've got the ditches. We jump in a ditch, and it landed, this rocket. It was a Chinese rocket. It landed and into a HESCO bastion. HESCO bastion is like a massive wire square with sandbags around it, and they fill it with stones, and it's basically just to protect the camp. And they build all the forward operating bases, patrol bases out of this stuff. So it landed directly in it, and then all the stones flew out and started hitting us. But obviously we didn't know it hadn't exploded. Well, it didn't explode, luckily, but we didn't know it didn't explode. And we were just running, and I was headbutting everyone because it was dark as well. And then all these stones started hitting the hangar, like just smashing the hangar and hitting us on the back of the heads and the neck and that. And then everyone was like, obviously checking themselves for blood and stuff like this. And obviously we realized it didn't explode, and it was really, really, like, it was really funny, like, just to, you know, it's a massive adrenaline rush. It was really funny. But that was week one. And then we had our briefing in the hangar, and we was getting told, you know, where we'd be based or where we'd be operating from and what we'd be doing and stuff like that.
So that was week one. And that's something that, I mean, it's like, where do you go from there? I mean, when that happens to you, were you kind of regretting or second guessing your, you know, joining the military?
No, not really. No, it's like we do a lot of training, a lot of really good training, and you're just, it's what you want to do. You know, I think once you've had that extent of training, you really want to do it. You really want to do it. So, you know, a Chinese rocket is what it is, you know, something that you can't stop. So, and obviously when you survive, you know, anything, you know, that can hurt you, it's seriously good feeling. So the adrenaline was just, it was really good buzz. I don't think anyone can replace that.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say it like that, that, you know, once you realize you survive, it's a really good feeling. It's like that adrenaline buzz that you get. I've never experienced anything like that. I've never been in a situation that I can recall that I felt like I could have died and I didn't. And the adrenaline that comes after that. But is the adrenaline that comes in after that, is that something that, because you know how like people can get addicted to the adrenaline rush and they're adrenaline junkies. Is that kind of like how you are, or was it more like, you know, it's the adrenaline rush, but you don't want to go through that again kind of thing?
No, it's pure addiction. Like, well, we could talk about it later in the show. Once we get through the stories, I think I can finish on that because it's pure addiction.
Okay, Ben. So what happens next?
So what happens next? We get split up. Our squadron gets split up, and we all go to different places. I was operating at Camp Bastion for 3 months. 6 months. Well, it's 3 months, a month in a FOB, and then another 2 months back at Camp Bastion. So we'd go out. Our first convoy was pretty chilled. It was a handover convoy. And so we'd have the guys we were handing over to with us as well. So it was kind of a mix, and they'd, you know, tell us all the standard operational procedures and stuff like that. It was basically a drive out into the desert. It takes about 18 hours there, and then you stay overnight, and then it's 18 hours back. So it's just like introducing us to, you know, a certain, you know, their standard operational procedures and what's going on, rather than getting us straight into the nitty-gritty. So that was a pretty chilled one. And then I got sent to work with a small armored group. So we would go out, and because the British military is like pretty understaffed, so you would get dispersed. Like, they'd tell you to be driving truck, and then next minute, you know, you're doing what I did. So for a few weeks, I got sent to a small armored group, and we would go out and watch the road before the convoy went through. So any road or track or whatever a vehicle drives down, if it's in a small road where you're going through a town, then this could be a dangerous area, because the road gets smaller or the area you can drive gets smaller, so the whole area needs to get watched. So we'd go out with 12 vehicles, and we would watch a certain area. So we'd be in a three vehicle group, and we would drive out before the convoy started, plot up, and watch the road. We'd watch the road for probably about 3 or 4 days before the convoy went through. Once the convoy's gone through, we'll pick up the tail end of that, go with them, and then come back with them as well. And then just be like a fire support for the convoy, if you like. On one of those ones where we was watching the road, so you'd have to watch it at night as well. Obviously, I was looking through the night vision goggles, and I was, you know, looking for someone near the road, looking at the houses, you know. And then I saw a guy, like, he was like getting up and down and up and down, but he was like 2 kilometers away, and it was kind of like blurry, and I couldn't really make it out. So I got my guy to look through the sights, and he was like, it looks like he's digging, you know, it looks like he's digging. He must be digging, you know, to bury an IED. That's what we thought. So we shot a flare, and then cocked the machine gun, and aimed it on him. But he was actually praying. He was about 2 kilometers away, and we couldn't actually figure it out. But once we shot the flare, we realized he was actually praying outside the front of his house. So that was quite interesting, how like things can get like escalated. And these guys have been out there already for 4 months. So that's how weird it was. And then in the daytime, we got up in the daytime and we were the middle group and we were stretched along 3 kilometers, I'd say. So we were a kilometer away at each, maybe a kilometer and a half away at each. And then the group on my left, they got contacted. They got shot out from a mountain that they were just below. So they, there was, I think, 12 of us per 3 vehicles. So 4 of them got their kit on and went up the mountain and they caught a guy up there and he said, "Oh no, I'm a farmer, I'm a farmer." He just ditched his weapons and he was firing at the vehicles. And when they got up there, they got up there on foot and they fire maneuvered forward and finally they caught him and they said, you know, he's like, "I'm a farmer, I'm a farmer." And he knew how to say that in English, but he didn't say anything else. He ditched his weapon. They put him in the truck. And we kept him for a few days until we picked up the convoy and come back and dropped him off to Camp Bastion.
What becomes of him after that? Do you know, is that just something where he becomes, he's held there at Camp Bastion for any length of time or a specific length of time?
Well, this is the question. The British don't really have a great, but the story goes that we hand them over to the Americans and then they deal with them. But, you know, it's never great. I've heard so many stories where they said they turn them into, they recruit them for the Afghan National Police. They recruit them for the Afghan National Army. I've heard they torture them. And to be honest, I don't know. We drop off Camp Bastion to the British and they fly into Kandahar. That's all I know.
Yeah. I was just curious. I just didn't know if you know what became of him after that point, that's all. I was just kind of curious. Yeah, that was just my own curiosity was piqued there.
I don't know either.
Yeah, I gotcha. It sounds like you know, when you first got there and you're getting, you know, your first 2 weeks there and you're firing in and you're getting the Chinese rocket coming in and kind of giving you that hello, you know, you're here in Afghanistan and then you're, you know, doing these kind of roadside watching things of what's going on. It just, there's so much that happens in these areas, in these battle areas that we just don't know here, you know, not just here in the States, but any of the citizens, you know, in England or here, you know, we have soldiers abroad. We're just kind of curious as to what goes on. So it's actually interesting. Thanks for actually coming on and talking with us about these things, because it is interesting to find out what happens and what goes on. But so where does this take you to next? What's the next step for you? What's the next thing that goes on for you guys?
To be honest, it was 12 years ago, so I can't really picture it day by day. I have my bullet points ready, so yeah, I'll just go through my bullet points. So we have the 36 hour convoy. That was one I remember. That was horrendous. That was really bad. So it's left Camp Bastion and went to a place called Fob Edinburgh. In the UK, Edinburgh is like really north of the UK, so I wonder why. I think that's why they called it Fob Edinburgh. And these guys out there, they were from my squadron as well. They were living up there for about 3 months at a time. And we drove up there, and then a lot of them come back with us and operate from Camp Bastion with us. So they'd been up there for 3 months. So the drive up there was absolutely horrendous. It was like raining, there was mud, everyone was getting stuck. And you're talking, you know, over 50 vehicles all in a convoy driving for 36 hours straight. Because the worst thing you want to do is stop. If you stop, then you become a target, you know. So the best thing to do is just carry on driving for as long as possible. So usually in a truck, you have the machine gunner and the driver, and you just swap shifts as often as you want, every hour, every 4 hours, every 6 hours, whenever you want. We didn't get into any contacts. I think we got mortared along the way, but when the mortars were landing, like, you don't stop anyway, you know, unless something's in your way, you just carry on, because you're not going to dismount and start a firefight. Like, it's just not going to happen. So you just carry on. I remember going up, we was in a massive wadi, which is like a giant ditch, and everyone was struggling to get out of it. And then all the kids started coming over, you know, and you have to shoot your mini flares and tell them to go away because a lot of the kids want food and stuff like that. So we got out the wadi. This was near the end. We could see the fob, and there was an American vehicle with us as well. So we have these are mixed convoys. We'll have Afghan National Army with us. We'll have Americans, sometimes Dutch. It could be anyone with us. And these guys were like stuck with that. I can't remember what truck they had, some sort of engineer's truck or something like that for like lifting out vehicles and stuff like that. And they were standing, and you've got to remember, it was like 2 foot of mud. So we're just sliding everywhere. There's no road. And we're just trying to get to the fob, you know, because we've been awake for like 36 hours. So it was just like driving. And then these Americans were like, "Hey, man, stop. And I was just like, I was on the gun, and I was like, just put my middle finger up, like, no chance, you know, just head straight for the fob. And we were like the first ones in the fob. And I've seen my guys who I haven't seen in like 3 months. So I was just like, I'll go to bed. Where's the beds? Let's get me a bed, you know. And we just literally cleaned our guns and went to bed. That was it. I slept for ages after. I think you slept for like 18 hours. We were knackered. But yeah, apologies to the American soldiers. We didn't get out of the mud. Sorry.
No worries. It's just funny when you think about those things. It's just really cool. It's really cool to hear. And, you know, I was kind of curious, you know, so this trip was 36 hour trip. It was just one straight shot, 36 hours that you were just driving.
Yeah, Yeah.
That is amazing. Yeah. How many vehicles were in the convoy? Do you know?
It was over 50, way over 50. I'd like to say 70.
Wow. That's just amazing. That is amazing to me. I can't imagine driving. I know. I mean, I drive here in the States and I get tired after 10 or 12 hours. Like I'm beat. I want to go home and go to bed. You know, I can't imagine doing that for 36 hours straight, just driving. And I realize, you know, you can change drivers off and on, but holy cow. I mean, 36 hours of sitting in the truck has got to drive you crazy.
But you're standing on the machine gun. So you're standing up and then you've got a gun to look after, you know.
Yeah.
And obviously to look out. And I did fall asleep standing up, so.
Wow, that's
there's nothing crazy you can do. And the next bullet point is the 611. So the 611 was labeled like the most dangerous road in Afghanistan. So we got a briefing, we heard about it, and yeah, we were all ready. We got really good briefings all the time, to be honest. We got a lot of information and we knew what we had to do. So it was a massive convoy. It must have been 3 kilometers long, some, I'm thinking 100 vehicles maybe. And we left Camp Bastion. It wasn't that far, but there's a point where it's called the Witch's Hat. And there's only one road in Afghanistan that we use. But once you come off that road, that's it. You're in the desert. So there's no actual roads. There's just sand and hard sand. So we drive and we will, you know, go wherever we want, basically. We won't pick a route. We won't follow tracks because we don't want to hit an IED, and we want to change our, like, routes all the time to avoid a contact or to avoid an ID or to avoid being stitched up. But once you go into the Witch's Hat, it is exactly that, is a Witch's Hat. So once you get to the tip, there's nothing you can do. You need to hit on this track and you need to go through, you know, through the town. So the buildings actually cause the Witch's Hat. So we're going up the 611. First thing I remember is just being there, and I remember giving fingers to one of the guys behind me, just joking and stuff, you know, trying to keep morale up. And then obviously we're getting where it's getting to be built up. So, you know, I just take the safety off, unclip the turret and just make sure it's moving and everything's moving freely. So if we do get contacted, you know, it's going to be instantly, I can turn the gun anywhere I like on the turret and move it. So we're driving down the road, and then the, well, not the road, near this on the sand, on the hard sand. And there's buildings all around us, and then the mortars start landing. And it's pretty often you'll have mortars, pretty much most convoys you'll have mortars land, and usually just drive through them. So everyone just carries on, just watching the mortars land. Then the vehicle in front of me gets hit by an RPG, which is a rocket propelled grenade. And he stopped, and then the Taliban started opening up in machine gun fire. And I was looking around, trying to figure out. I couldn't figure out where they were. And then my mate's just like banging me on my leg. Look up. He's over there on the bund line in the blue. So I was at like the 11 o'clock position. I turned to the 9 o'clock position, and I can see him. So I duck down and get behind the machine gun, and then give off three bursts of 3 to 4 rounds. And he went away. Like he must have fell behind this bund line. It's like a giant ditch. And you don't really think about it, you know, it's like target practice. And then my mate's like punching me in the leg, like, you fucking got him. So I was like, okay, well, I've done a great job, you know. So moving on, the convoy is, as I said, nearly 3 kilometers long. So we were in, like, at that point, our vehicles were in the kill zone. So the guy in front that got RPG'd, he's like stuck. We've got procedures where the guy in front of you, if you get a flat tire or whatever while you're being shot at, then the guy in front of you will dismount a tow bar. It's a metal tow bar. Everyone has one, or every other vehicle has one. So he dismounted it. He latched him on. Luckily, the RPG, I think it hit the bottom of his tire. So it just exploded up through the engine bay. So no one was hurt. They weren't hurt. They were all good to go. I got the thumbs up from the machine gunner, and they were going. By the time I dropped that guy, they were going. So we carried on. And then I drove past one of my really good friends, and he was shooting the mortar pit. And he was he's putting the rounds down at the mortar pit. The Taliban must have left by then, and they were just trying to destroy it. Carried on past him, and then there was another building, like a house, and I could see there was a small armored vehicle on top of the hill. And they were when I was watching roads, they were that team watching the roads, and he was putting machine gun fire down on the right hand side of the house. And I could see the back door, and I see two guys run round to the back door and go in that way. So I started firing at that door and the windows just to try and keep them inside so they wouldn't, you know, shoot at us, if you like. So I was just firing and then waiting for the driver to carry on, you know, conserving my ammo, doing it as necessary, you know, not being ridiculous with it. I heard on the radio, like, other call signs, telling other call signs to stop firing, and, you know, other stuff like this. So it was all pretty chaotic, if you like. And then after that we got through, I didn't see those two guys come back out, so I really don't know what happened to them. We carried on, we got through, and then there was like a little white Nissan just drove like 20 feet from me with four guys in it, like sort of Afghan males in it, you know. Like, and I was thinking, well, what are they doing? So I had my gun facing the 3 o'clock, because everyone was facing the 9 o'clock. So I thought, well, we're out of contact, well, we broke contact, I'll face the 3 o'clock, you know, just in case there's another enemy position there. And they pulled up 20 feet from me, and I was like screaming at them, like, what are you doing? Get back. And it was so strange, you know, having those four guys in a Nissan Micra just next to me. It was just surreal. So we carried on moving anyway. It was a KBR guy from Afghanistan, works for KBR, and he was driving fuel. And he was just under a bun line. He got out his vehicle. He's under a bun line, just holding his head, like, and just screaming. So he was, I don't think he was shot. He was just like in shock of what was going on. Anyway, carried on driving. Finally got to the forward operating base, and yeah, dismounted at a break. That some laughs, you know, as well, because we all got through in the end. I don't think. No one got hurt or injured or anything. So it was pretty cool when we got there. We were like dismounted, offloaded all our gear, picked up all the rubbish or, you know, the empty shipping containers, because we were driving drops, which is shipping container vehicles that have an arm on the back and they pick them up on a hook. So we'd just drop a shipping container and pick up an empty, or not pick up anything, just pick up a flatbed or whatever. So it was all just buzzing, and then, yeah, got more ammunition. You know, I asked for like 6,000 rounds, as much as I could get. You know, for because we had to drive back. Obviously, we couldn't stay there.
So it sounds like it's been an interesting ride to this point while you're in the military. And do you think that the way you reacted to the stuff that you experienced? Do you think that the people around you, the people that you're working with, do you think that they responded the same way, or did you see other people respond maybe a little bit more emotional or whatever? I mean, going through some of these situations and stuff, I can't imagine everybody reacts the same way.
It's weird because we've done a lot of training. You know, we've done a lot of training, a lot of firing, so it's just another day, but.
Yeah,
you know, it's real bullets, it's real mortars, that's it. And we do live firing exercises anyway, so it's not like, you know, we haven't heard it before, I haven't seen it before. You know, we've seen the rounds, we've seen what they look like, we've heard it all, you know. So it's kind, you know, it's very, very similar to what you do in training. So, and you can't process that amount of information in you, like, once that had happened, I didn't even, you know, realize what had happened. Do you know what I mean? I just remember speaking to one of my closest friends when he got off of his truck and he had a bullet hole in his wing mirror. And I was like, he was like, yeah, man, the rounds were so close. Because we didn't have any armor on these vehicles in 2008. So basically, all you had was a truck with a cab, normal windows, and then all you'd have is a plate of armor below the door. That's it. So he had a bullet hole in his wing mirror, and he was like, yeah, man, da, 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 and he's laughing about it. And I was like, man, those bullets got really close. And then his driver went, he's talking rubbish. He was firing his rifle out the window, you know, and he shot his mirror while he was driving, like doing some sort of gangster drive-by, you know what I mean? You know, so you just laugh about it, you know, and it's, as I said before, it's a great feeling to come out of a situation like that on top, you know. And the Taliban executed that attack like perfectly, you know, perfectly. But they just, you know, I just don't think they had enough guys on the ground or enough firepower, and that's it. But if you think about it, I think they've done extraordinarily well. If they, you know, so it's, you know, it was a fair fight at the end of the day, but they just didn't have enough firepower. It could have went on for longer, you know, and it took hours for the rest of the convoy to get through. But yeah, we don't process it that quickly, so people won't start crying, or they'll just won't talk. But, you know, so I know one guy didn't say much. But again, you can't. I just don't think you can process it that quickly. You know, obviously, if you start seeing limbs and that, then it's completely different. But, you know, they were over 100 meters away, so, you know, we wasn't going to see anything too shocking.
Yeah, I find it interesting though. I mean, the violence and everything around you is all part of your environment, and so in that moment, you guys can find a way to laugh about it, joke about it, make, you know, jokes and all that stuff. And from the outside looking in, I'm just like, how do you keep your sanity? Because I'm thinking to myself, if I had that stuff happen to me, I would just be like, I would be shaken. I mean, I wouldn't be joking around. I'd be like, I'd be calling for my mom. I want to go home, you know?
Yeah. As I said before, it's the training, because I've been on like ranges, firing exercises, which have been like absolutely draining, you know, like massive, massive miles of marching that, you know, you just want your leg to break, you know? So it's the training that does it, you know? It's really the training. You get in a situation like that, you can, and as I said before, you can execute it well because you're training, but, you know, you can, if you survive like an experience like that, then you have to see the fun side of it. What are you gonna do? Laugh or cry?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just when I hear you describe it, though, it's like if you survive. All right. So let me ask you this: in those moments, is it very much? Are you very much aware of the fact that you could have almost died, or is it something that you think about later? But in the moment with the adrenaline, you're not really thinking about the fact that you almost died. That your last thought or your last word could have happened 5 minutes ago, but rather the adrenaline's pumping and you're just like exhilarated.
Yeah, you just exhilarated. There's no other feeling like it, and you can't process it. It took me so long to process what I'd done. It took me about 3 years because no one really asked me the question, you know, have you killed someone? And even now saying that is very strange, because in my mind, in my mind years ago after that happened, I just didn't even think about it, you know? It's very strange. I can't really explain it. It's like, yeah, it took me 3 years. I explained because I never told this story before to a lot of people. So I've only sold bits of my tour in Afghanistan. If I liked someone and they asked me a question at a certain time, yeah, I would tell them something. But I would never explain the whole thing, what I'm doing now. But I didn't process that for 3 years. It was like I just went to the back of my head. I never done that. Or I just didn't think about it. Or I couldn't bring it to the front of my head and say, this is what happened. I don't know why. I just didn't, only till like 8 years ago, maybe 7 years ago.
That's interesting.
It sounds like it's almost like a coping mechanism that allows you to be able to deal with things that you saw and things that went on. And it's totally understandable. You know, it doesn't stay in the forefront of your mind, because how would you cope with all of that and live your daily life in civilian life? You know, so I mean, in my mind, that's, you know, what I would think is it's kind of a coping mechanism that enables you to be able to keep functioning as, you know, and living life.
Yeah. And the military is so fast paced where you don't really get that time to sit back and chill for a week and be normal, or, you know, just chill out and someone go to you. So, you know, no one's really got 2 hours to listen to this, you know? So it is a weird thing. And I don't really want to tell, I didn't really want to tell people before. I never wanted to tell anyone anything. You know, in London, you get judged. You know, I wouldn't even tell them I was in the military before. You get judged a lot.
Really? So, okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't, if I walked into a bar, I wouldn't ever mention it. Just wouldn't mention it. Just wouldn't be a thing. Just in case, you know, someone wanted to ask you something or tell you something, you know, someone talked rubbish, or it's just one of those.
Yeah, so I don't want to cut you off. I don't know if, I know you're running off a bullet list of, you know, experiences that you wanted to share. So I'll let you just continue down that list of stuff, because I don't want to kind of cut you off and veer off into other conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So we left the FOB. So we finished the firefight. We got to the FOB. We dropped off our shipping containers. We got a detail, orders to leave about 6 hours later. It was the middle of the night now. That was daytime. So it's middle of the night, we're leaving. The guy driving on the way there was like, I'm on the gun tonight. Like, he was hanging out. He wanted to get on the gun and, you know, use it a bit. So we got our brief. It was like, yeah, we're going to get smashed on the way out. We have to stay vigilant. They're going to shoot us. You know for a fact they're going to do the same thing. So I'm driving out. He's on the gun. And then, yeah, it just all kicks off. It was just small arms come in, small arms fire. We were laying down the fire again. And I was driving the truck. The convoy was going so slow at this time. It was going like, it was stop, start. And we kept getting into firefights, you know, and it was just taking forever. And I knew something wasn't right, because they would just pop up and shoot, and you'd see a couple muzzle flashes, and then they'd just go back down again. So they weren't trying to fight us. They were just trying to slow us down. And obviously everyone on the guns were just laying fire down. I was just hiding behind that metal bit of armor below the glass window and driving like that, because, you know, I was just wanted to get behind some cover while I was driving. So anyway, we're driving along. And I had a really deep explosion, but it was from, you know, well, I know it was from about 2 kilometers away. It was like massive explosion, but you can feel the vibration through the ground, and, you know, it can go through you. And I was like, that is massive. It's because we've heard it a lot before this. It's an IED. Everyone knows it's an IED, so it's a stop. So we're all stopping. And the lead vehicle was massive, never been breached before, so it's never been... the underbelly of the vehicle has never been breached. No one inside's ever been killed. So we heard on the radio that the lead vehicle's been hit by an IED, and they're going to split up the convoy. They're going to split up the people in the truck. Another truck's going to go forward and tow it. So we drive with these tow trucks as well. So other people, engineers, mechanics will drive with tow trucks. Usually, depending on the size of the convoy, you can have 2, 3, 4, 5 in the convoy, just in case something like this happens. So they drive to the front, they go pick up the Mastiff, and then we get, our call sign comes up, we're going to get a medic in our truck. So he jumps in our truck, he comes running down the side of the vehicles, like, still in like this villagey area. He comes running down the side of vehicles, and it's like, you know, we've never met him before, don't know who he is. And it's like, oh, mate. So what happened? He's like, oh, mate, so crazy. So he said, obviously, the explosion went off, but the lights went out. And then I just felt all this wet stuff all over my face. And he was only like 20 years old. And he was like thinking, he said, I was thinking that's everyone's blood. And then he put on his torch, and it wasn't. The water bottles inside the vehicle had exploded through the pressure. And that was it. But everyone inside survived. So we were just laughing at him, you know, trying to make him, because he was shaking, you know, we was just laughing at him and laughing at him. It's like, mate, you know.
So that's an interesting situation that you have there. Do you think that this is going to be something that you're going to be kind of dealing with for the rest of your life, whether it's, you know, reminiscing on the funny good times, or, you know, dealing with more of the traumatic stuff? Because it sounds like you kind of process this stuff pretty well. It doesn't sound like it affected you too negatively. I'm assuming you kind of dealt with this pretty well.
Yeah, I hope to think I did. But as the story gets darker, so I'll just move on.
Okay.
So we carry on, and then it's getting late. We drive past 2 bodies on the side of the road, and the force protection must have shot them for coming too close, because they were wrapped up on the side of the road, near one of the houses, side of the compacted sand road, if you like. And so we carry on, we're looking, and we're thinking, oh my God, what's happened, you know? And so we carry on, and then I honestly can't remember if it was this convoy or another convoy where there was a gap in the convoy, because it was going on for so long. I believe it was this convoy. It was going on for so long where they were holding us with small arms fire, that there was people were falling asleep in their trucks while they were driving. And what the Taliban had done is ran into the track we were using, and then just quickly planted an IED. They'll wrap it in plastic. And then the guy that was driving behind the guy that fell asleep, the guy got told, you know, because you have force protection driving around like wherever they want in the Land Rovers. They'll just drive around wherever they want and like protect the convoy, if you like. And they were like bibbing him, whatever. So he woke up. He's driven off. Matey's not noticed or whatever. I don't know. And there was a gap. So there's this gap. And then when he was driving, he saw the guy in front must have drove past it. I don't know. But he said, I heard on the radio, look, we spotted an IED. We're going to have to do Obama. Obama's when you get the metal detectors out and check for metal within the sand or the track to see if there's an IED. Lo and behold, there was an IED. And, you know, that's 50 vehicles gone over it. So they were planting it in between our vehicles. So he red flagged it. So he just put flags all around it, put a massive sign, and then everyone else just drove around it. So we all drove around it when we're driving around it, because we had to go down a wadi rather than, you know, over this, not bridge, but other part of the road, other part of the area we were driving. So that was pretty, you know, hairy at the moment, hearing it, like, oh my gosh, they're planting IEDs in between our vehicles, you know, like that's how close they were getting to us. They were like literally, because at night you can't see anything around you. You know, once it's dark, there's no ambient lights, no street lights. You're just in a village. You've got your headlights, they go forward, they don't go sideways. You can't see anything. It's absolute, especially when it's standing still. And we can see it's like the rooftops or a bit of smoke coming out of buildings. It's absolutely, especially when it's quiet, it's absolutely surreal. It's really scary. Anyway, we luckily, I remember the feeling of hitting that tarmac road, and we hit the tarmac road and we knew we were safe-ish, you know. We were pretty safe, and then straight back to Camp Bastion. And that was that convoy. We had other ones where we were driving to build FOBs or reinforce forward operating bases or patrol bases, build patrol bases. So we went out on one, I believe this is earlier in my tour, we went out on one with a mix of people, and we were going to drop them off. We were dropping off trucks, we were dropping off vehicles. So I was in a vehicle with some guy, I've never met him before. I think he was an engineer, I'm not sure. He was on a machine gun, and I was driving truck because he couldn't drive the truck. And I remember there was JCBs on it, everything. There were small armored tanks on it as well. One of these tanks is like, it's not really a tank. It's a small articulated vehicle. And it's tracked, and it can hold like, I think, up to 12 people. So there was like 10 of them at the front. We were all driving down this road. It wasn't tarmac, but we could only stay on there. There was a massive ditch on the left, and there was buildings on the right. So we have to go down this road. Usually when you go down the road, it's usually most of it's being watched from a forward operating base, this road anyway. But a lot of it, like a kilometre of it, could be not. So you have to do Obama. You have to check with the metal detectors. So the convoy is taking ages. Metal detector, the guys are searching with the metal detectors, and then we start moving, and then boom, same again, hear a massive explosion, and then we just stopped. Nothing come over the net. I think everyone realized, and we were just sitting there. I was sitting in the truck, and the guy on the gun, never met him before, he was like, there was kids all running around, not loads of them, there was like three or four of them running around, and they were all disabled. They all had, one of them had only arms on their shoulders, only hands on their shoulders, and the other one had arms down to his knees. And there was a really small child there, probably about 2 years old. I didn't see any deformities, but these children were deformed. And he was like, oh, pass me the ration pack, like your equivalent to an MRE. And we have chewing gum in there. And he was biting the chewing gum in half and throwing them in the mud. And not making them, but watching them fight. And I watched that for about 45 minutes. I didn't say anything. That was really, really frustrating for me to watch. I didn't know him from Adam, and I could have done something. I never. And so he was throwing the chewing gum, watching them fight. And then the Afghan National Police come out of their little building, and they started throwing stones at him. And I was just thinking, where the fuck am I? You know what I mean? I need to get out of here. That was really, really crushing for me. Like that was probably one of the worst things. But then the vehicle started moving, and we got called forwards, all the drops vehicles, so all the trucks that drive shipping containers got called forward. So we all went forward. We moved forward, and then we seen this small tank, and it was just fucking destroyed. The driver's seat, had shot up, and there was only probably the size of like an A3 paper in square, like an A3 paper square size, like half a meter by half a meter cube size, left in the vehicle, and there was just blood everywhere. So this guy had clearly, like, is obviously British, or assume British, and he's clearly lost his legs. And there we were fucking about with these kids, you know, like, it's just mind, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. And then we got his, got, obviously he got flown out, the helicopter come, picked him up, took him to Camp Bastion. I don't know the guy, I hope he survived, you know. We put his vehicle onto a rack, strapped it down, and then picked it up, and then carried on, dropped everything off at the forward operating base, or patrol base. I can't remember, it was pretty small. And then, travel back at night.
You know, when you're mentioning about the IEDs being put in between vehicles as you guys drove over, I mean, that to me, that sounds terrifying, because you just never know when you could hit something like that. Because if they're getting up that close to you guys, then, I mean, there was really no sense of security in my mind.
No, there's no sense, especially on that last one I just described. The guy's done up bomber at the front. They missed an IED. It's not their fault. It happens. Stuff happens. The sixth vehicle back hit the IED and exploded. So it could be anyone at any time. You do have that in your mind, you know. And that does, yeah, that it is a feeling that you can't shake when you're in a vehicle, you know, especially when you go through these small roads, small villages where you have to use, when you're out in the desert, you know, you think you're safe as houses. And I have one story where we were on that route. I explained that the first route we'd done. So we're driving back, and we're about 4 or 5 months in. This is the easy one. We never get contacted. We never even get mortared on this one. So we usually do it 18 hours there, 18 hours back, whatever. We just do it. And we get stopped. It's nighttime, and we get stopped. There's a message over the radio like, guys, we're going to bunk up here. We're going to do this, do that. And I was thinking, why are we stopping? Like, it's just ridiculous. And I was getting really like angry. And then they told us the formation for the vehicles to go in, force protection to go 1 kilometer out, and then sentry positions are going to be here, so everyone has to take a turn on the gun. We all got out and got our briefing from our command, our like platoon commanders, and then we were thinking like, what the hell is going on? And what had happened, because we never stopped, what had happened is there was a special forces group that were using that route that we use. And they had driven down their own tracks in the middle of the desert. I'm talking the middle of the desert, where you would never see a living soul for 18 hours. It's the middle of the desert, yeah? So they're driven out and then used their own tracks to come back. And lo and behold, there was an IED, and it lifted, I think, all four of them. But I'm not sure. But the way the vehicle looked, because I saw it get back to Camp Bastion, because somebody, I think it was a senior, like a staff sergeant or a colour sergeant, picked it up on his rack, and no one knew about it. They didn't want us to know about it, you know, what had happened. And they wrapped it up, and I saw it back in the graveyard, where we put all the exploded vehicles and broken vehicles in Camp Bastion. I saw it there, and it was one of the new vehicles that, you know, no one else has got. So obviously, it's special forces. And we had our briefing later that day, and our commanding officer told us what had happened and said, yeah, they used their own tracks. You know, this can happen to anyone. You know, this is a special forces group. I don't know if they were support or special forces, but they were part of a special forces group, and they weren't wearing helmets, and they weren't they're wearing baseball caps as well. And, you know, this is it. You have to be that kind of person. Even if you're in the middle of the desert, you can't use your own tracks. We never use our own tracks. You know, you can't ever become complacent. You know, that was, you know, getting all this information back was very, very scary. Very, like, you know, you need to be about yourself all the time. It's, they're hidden everywhere. They're everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating to know. And it's like a Russian roulette game every day. I mean, you are playing Russian roulette every day. And, you know, even just not being able to run back in your own tracks is just, I don't know how you comprehend, how do you process that, I guess, is the way to say it. You know, how you process that, the tension that it leaves you in on a daily basis has got to be, you know, I don't know how you deal with that. I guess that's the question as to, you know, why there's PTSD when you guys come back and how you process those things. But I did want to ask you a question about the kids who were disabled that you were talking about the last, that last convoy you were talking about. Do you know why they were disabled? I mean, were they, victims of IEDs or explosions or anything like that? Or do you know what the cause was there? I don't mean to be insensitive when I ask the question. I don't mean it that way. I'm just curious. That's all.
Yeah, I was curious myself. I know the Russians in the '80s done some nasty things. They dropped a million, we call them helicopter plant, acorn seeds or helicopter seeds. And when they fall off the tree, they spin like a helicopter. So they designed a little small IED, and they dropped a million of them all over Afghanistan. And when you shake them, they explode. And they were for children to pick up. This is what the Russians were doing. So we get briefings before we go to Afghanistan and all the history and learn, you know, history of wars and stuff like that. So maybe they dropped something toxic. I wouldn't put it past them. They dropped something toxic, or it could be interbreeding, because they're very small villages out there, you know, and it does happen. It happens all over the world. I'm not just saying that there's small villages all over the world where stuff like that happens. But yeah, it wasn't an explosion, because the girl's hands were attached to her shoulders. So it wasn't an explosion. They were just, she had no arms. And then the boy had really long arms.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, I was just, you know, but I agree that it happens everywhere, that those kinds of birth defects. And that. The other question I had for you, Dave, was when we talk about, I mean, we've been talking now about convoys and that kind of stuff. And here in the United States, you know, when we think about convoys, we think about, you know, trucks driving down the highway together doing 65, 70 miles an hour. I'm curious, and this is just a question that I have out for myself, how fast are the convoys actually traveling over there? Like, how fast are you guys going in these? I'm assuming you're not doing 65 or 70 miles an hour, and that's why I'm asking the question. Kind of put it in perspective for people so they can understand you're traveling at whatever speed you are for the 18 hours or 36-hour trips that you're doing, and that's why I'm asking the question. Do you know what the speed is that the convoys were doing over there?
Yeah, they'll do as fast as possible. We will do as fast as possible. If you're getting shot at and you're getting slowed down, people slow down naturally, even the driver, to have a look, get information off the commander. You can't drive and take information in, so you'll slow down naturally. But when we're out in the desert, it's full pelt. We'll try and go 50 miles an hour. I remember driving, we was in the middle of the desert, there was a mountain, and we were getting mortared. We were going to an American base to do a resupply, and we were getting mortared. And the mortars were coming from the mountain, and we just put our foot down. I remember going 50, 55 in the middle of the desert, just like all the dust everywhere. You just go for it, you know. You want to get there as quick as possible, obviously as safely as possible. When you go through villages, you have to slow down. You know, we do stick to 30 miles an hour, believe it or not, when we go through villages. But, yeah, as when you know, it's a massive convoy. So when you're going up a hill, you know, people get stuck and stuff like that. So you'll go as fast as you can. Yeah. You want to get the job done.
Yeah, sure. And like I said, I was just curious because, I mean, in talking with you, I was just curious what, you know, how fast the convoys were going and that kind of stuff. That was just a personal question for myself. I appreciate it. Thank you.
No worries. There is a story I'd like to mention. So we had a sister squadron, if you like. So when we were resting, they would go out on ops. they were going on operations, vice versa. They went out on an operation, and one vehicle broke down. It was one of those small tanks I was speaking about earlier, small track vehicles. And he went out to fix it, and there was another two guys with him. Like, obviously, one must have been the driver, one must have been the, you know, could have been passenger, whatever. There was three of them there looking at the vehicle, and then a small child with a wheelbarrow wheeled up to them, and then explosives detonated and killed all three of them. And one of them was someone I knew. Someone was in my regiment back home. And yeah, it's a sad thing to have a child, you know, do that. Obviously, the child didn't do it. The Taliban forced them to do it, or forced their family to do it. I mean, later on, I think 2 or 3 months later, we got a briefing from intelligence, which we should have had at the start, about how they operate. And how they operate is they take these disabled children. So they'll go to a family. Say you've got kids, they'll go to your family and they'll say, look, we'll give you $3,000 for your disabled child. And they will sell it. They will sell their child. And then they will use them for stuff like this, you know. And that's what we were told by our British intelligence. And yeah, it was like a 11-year-old child that detonated. I got told it was a she, but when I read the newspapers, it was a he. I got told it was like a 7-year-old girl, but I think in the papers they reported 11-year-old boy. So I'm not sure. They died as well. So it was 4 people, you know, dead. It was just that really, really hit home for us. And that was the turning point. After that, it was, you know, like for us, it was no holds bar. We just didn't care. We absolutely didn't care. I remember getting off that convoy on a 611, and that incident already had happened after we'd had that firefight. When we come back, someone from our sister company, we were there getting a debrief, and someone from our sister company was like, oh, there's been reports that you guys were shooting women and children. Obviously, he used to work close with his commanding officer, and he was telling us, but he was like a young soldier, so a junior rank, and he was telling us. And then one of my mates just shouted at him and said, yeah, I don't care how many, give me a number, I don't care. Do you know what I mean? So our attitudes absolutely changed after that. We just didn't care, you know. And it's really sad, and that's a point that, you know, brings it home, where your attitude changed because you're not fighting a normal you're not fighting a normal army. It's guerrilla warfare. Anything goes, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing to think about that for people who don't experience that. It's hard for us to imagine how you process that, how you cope with that, and how you deal with it when you're there, knowing that this is how it's going to be. It's going to be an all-in type of situation where, you know, you have to do whatever you have to do. But is there anything else you want to talk about there, Dave? Is there anything else that you have on your list?
Yeah, I've just got one more thing. So obviously our attitudes changed, and then I know up north, someone hit a kid, someone crashed into a kid, and they died near Kandahar. I think it was British troops that did it. It just got swept under the rug. We really didn't care anymore, you know. That we were driving out of, I remember driving out of a FOB in the green zone. It's like pretty hairy. The green zone is like where all the greenery is, if you like. There's a lot of greenery in Afghanistan as well. So there'll be a lot of trees and palm trees and bushes and wadis and swamps and stuff. And we was driving out, and I was on the gun, and there was kids like running into the road, and the guy in front of us was chucking sweets, and then the kids were running into the road. My mate just swerved. And I remember, because my hip, I couldn't see the kids, but I hit my hip against the turret, and I was like swearing. I was like, what are you doing? What are you doing? He's like, he's throwing sweets at the kids, this and that. I was like, what the fuck? Why are the kids out there? Because we're doing 40 miles an hour. you know, trying to get out of this town because it's unsafe. You get shot at, you know, when you're leaving or going into a patrol base. So we left. We went. That incident happened. My mate got on the radio and told him not to throw sweets, and I was just fuming at this point. So we have water bottles. All of our water is in water bottles. So we just have water bottles in the truck. I got a water bottle, filled it up with powder, like a red powder. But we didn't have Gatorade. The British only got issued like powdered juice. It's weird. So I filled it up with a red powder and I urinated in it. And then I put the lid back on and I threw it to a group of kids and they all started drinking it. And that is what really haunts me to this day, that I done that and I didn't. I wish I could take that back.
Yeah, I can understand, man. It sounds like being over there changed you as a person in a sense, at least temporarily. I don't know how you have developed or, you know, progressed since then, but hearing you share these stories, it sounds like there's a sense of a cynical nature that kind of came over you while you were over there. Is that how it kind of was? I mean, kind of like changed things that you normally wouldn't have done or even thought about doing, you did because of the environment you found yourself in?
Yeah, 100%. That's it. 100%. I regret it to this day.
I can understand, man. I can understand. I mean, man, I don't know. I don't even know where to go with that, because like, obviously you regret it. Obviously, you know, you shouldn't have done it. I can sit here and say, oh, I don't understand how somebody could do that. But when you're in an environment like you were in for so long, it's not something that you wake up one day and you're like, I'm going to do this. It's like, it's a slow progress, because it takes a toll on your psyche and it changes who we are when you're, I use different examples, you know, from time to time, but, and this is nothing on the level of what you dealt with, but when I was younger, I was in my early 20s, I worked in a city where I was writing, you know, just traffic tickets, like parking tickets and stuff. And it changed me. It changed me. And I after, over a year period of doing that, for the first year, I went from being somebody who was scared to go to work every day because I knew I was going to encounter conflicts with people, to not feeling anything when I went to work, to becoming very cynical and almost looking for, you know, the next person that's going to try to test me on something and start game planning in my head what I'm going to do and this, that, and the other. And it accumulated to a point where I put myself in a situation. Now, granted, the guy was, you know, abusing a woman, but I did put myself in a situation where I had that opportunity to get in a fight. And I wound up getting in a fight and there was a gun involved, and it scared me so bad I started driving truck. And so but it's like one of those things where the environment you find yourself in over a period of time, when it's a negative environment, it changes people. And it's like you don't know how you got there, but at some point that's where you wound up at.
Definitely, you become the enemy. That's what you become, that guy with the gun who you were trying to give a parking ticket to. You become him, and I had become, well, not to that extent, but my feeling towards children had completely changed, you know. And I remember I had a girlfriend, and she had a child, and I would go visit her on and off. She was lived quite far away, so I had to fly, and I would go visit her on and off, and it would be on the weekend. So one weekend a month, whatever, and usually she'd get a babysitter, or she would get her ex to look after the kid. And I couldn't. One Sunday, she brought the kid over. She couldn't even look at her child. And then we actually split up after this because I didn't. She drove me to the airport, and I wouldn't even acknowledge that she had a child, and I didn't even say goodbye. I just walked away. I shut the car door and I walked and I got on the plane and never saw her again because she had a child.
Wow. It definitely affected you. So I take back what I said earlier in the interview about how it seems like it didn't affect you. It clearly, this environment affected you in a negative sense. So how have you bounced back since then? Have you bounced back? Can you stand around? Can you stand being around kids? Do you have your own kids? How did it all kind of unfold for you?
Yeah, believe it or not, I'm probably the luckiest man in the world. I have two beautiful children. You know, when someone says, oh, your kids are cute, and they're probably not, or mine are, they're the most beautiful children in the world. And it's unbelievable. I can't believe it. I literally can't believe it.
Yeah. And that is, that's awesome. It really is. You know, the thing with it, it's as human beings, we become this, you know, we become the situation that we're living in. It's how we are, you know, we, and that's one of the things that we have to be careful of. But I, you know, having listened to your stories and know what you, you know, at least have an idea and hear your side of things and what you experienced. War brings out the worst at times in all of us. You know, when you look at it, you know, that's just how it is. That is just, it's the nature of what it is. And so, you know, if you didn't feel bad about what had transpired, then I would be worried. But that you do, and that you understand, and yeah, I mean, that would be a concern in the everyday life. If, you know, we walk through life and we didn't regret things, we didn't have regrets, that means that somehow we've walked through life being perfect and not making mistakes. And I don't think any of us have done that. So, you know, I think it's fascinating the your friend who you knew and being involved in an IED incident and all of those things, all that stuff combined works on a person. And when it does, it doesn't, oh, you know, it affects things in a negative way, and it can affect things in a negative way for a long time. It's just, you know, so that this, you know, what I'm saying is that I get it, and there's no judgment on any of this stuff. This is just human beings being human beings. And I guess the thing that we have to remember, and I think it was Nietzsche who said that in hunting monsters, we have to be careful that we don't become the monsters ourselves. And that's the thing that's just the reality of life. And I think that's a good point. And, you know, man, I just want my hat's off to all the people who have served, whether it's British service or American servicemen and women. My hat is off to anybody who puts himself in harm's way, like you did. And like some of the other guests that we've talked to, and just every service member that is out there. I appreciate you coming on and being honest and talking with us. It was really an interesting conversation. It was really interesting to hear the things that you talked about. And I didn't know if you had any other thoughts that you wanted to finish up with, that you wanted to talk about, that you wanted to bring up, but feel free. If there's anything else you want to talk about there, Dave, go right ahead and feel free to, you know, say whatever you wanted to say.
Just getting back to camp. That's also getting back to Britain. Thanks for that, Brian. Anyway, that was really good. That was really good, that information you gave there. I've took that on board. Sorry, I didn't mean to crack on with another story, but that was really good information. Yeah, I've taken that on board, and it does make sense. And I have recognised that all these things that happened were wrong. I do know right from wrong, you know, and I'm not that person. It's just, I know that's what I did. And I only accepted that probably 5 years ago, I reckon. But anyway, we got back to Britain, got back to the UK. The guy that died from my regiment, who from the Wilbur incident, he had a wife and a son, and his wife was pregnant, and she lost a baby as well. But we, tradition in the Navy, in the Royal Navy, to sell their equipment. So we had so you would sell, if a sailor dies abroad or dies on ship or out at sea, it goes back to I don't know, 1600s, they will sell his kit and give it to, give the money to the spouse. So we had this briefing. There was like probably about 300 of us in this hangar, and where we were selling his kit. Obviously, it's modern day now. a lot of people have a lot of money and they want to give their money. It's all military personnel, but we don't want to buy his kit. We want to raise money. So there was a big show and stuff like that. Someone put on all his underpants and took them off one by one and sold them one by one, you know, for like £20, the equivalent of like $30 for a pair of underpants and stuff. And I remember I was with my platoon and we was like, oh, so what should we buy, this and that. It's just like, just wait for someone to buy something and then we'll break it and buy something else off. We'll buy something off them. I was like, okay. So there was Norway pots and pans, like pots and pans you get issued for Norway, like cooking pots and pans. And some guy offered like, there was a set of three, and they're expensive anyway, and he offered like £50. And so we offered £100, which is £50, like $80. So we offered like the equivalent of $200 if he snapped all the handles off and just gave us the handles. So yeah, and I think we raised a lot of money for his wife, yeah, that day. So
it was
a really good day.
It sounds like it. It really does. And that's fantastic. That really is. And Dave, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on. I really do. It really was. I'm glad we finally got this conversation in, because it was really good. I enjoyed talking with you. I know Tony enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah, Dave, I tell you, man, one, I'm glad that we did get this done, because I know this was like the third time we've been trying to get this recording done. But I'm really glad that we did get the recording done. And the stories that you shared with us, I think you did a good job drawing us into it, because, you know, halfway through the interview, I was thinking, oh man, this is kind of fun, and this, that, and the other. And then it got real serious. And dude, listen, my hat goes off to you. I'm glad that you have beautiful kids and you love them dearly. And I just want people to understand that, you know, negative situations, negative environments that we find ourselves in, they change us. And I think what you shared with us can be an example for people to look at and say, maybe not say, but to take your example and then apply that to other people and understand that you don't know where people are coming from, and you don't know who they really are, especially. Well, I'm just going to say it, the environment that we find ourselves in right now globally, but specifically here in the States. I know you guys had protests and everything in London. Well, I think Derek, that cop that killed George Floyd, that murdered George Floyd, that quote you said, what was it?
Nietzsche.
Yeah. What was it again?
When hunting monsters, we have to be careful that we don't become monsters ourselves.
That quote. And so, when hunting monsters, we need to be careful we don't become monsters ourselves. I think Derek became a monster. He became a monster of the environment that he found himself in. He became a monster. And whether you're a police officer, you're in the military, when you find yourself in environments that are particularly negative all the time, it's one, your personal responsibility that you keep yourself in check psychologically to make sure that you're not becoming the environment that you're trying to protect or whatever it is. But also, I think it's important that our military, you know, the UK, their military, our police, the organizations around the individual that's in the environment, I think it's important that they start maybe stepping up their game and making sure that, you know, understanding that these guys are in a very negative environment all the time, and we need to keep up on them and make sure that not just physically they're okay, but psychologically they're okay as well. Because I mean, like with what you said earlier with that last story, it's clear to me that one thing's for sure, in that moment, psychologically, you weren't okay. Because it changed. You changed as a human being. And because you became a product of that environment. And so, Dave, I appreciate you sharing that story. And I appreciate you sharing that, how you've bounced back from that as well. I think there's a lot of hope for people that find themselves either in the military, in law enforcement, that maybe find themselves getting bogged down mentally with a lot of negativity. There's hope to bounce back, but you have to recognize it yourself and understand that, you know, at some point you might need to pump the brakes and say, I need to get some help, or else, you know, something bad could really happen, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I don't want to go down the George Floyd conversation, but it's definitely that police officer was a monster. Yes. That is it. Where he got it from or whatever, whatever happened to him, something bad happened to him. He's not human, you know? He's not human to do that to someone. I reckon he was very, very scared, very ill-equipped, very low-skilled, and, you know, must have seen something horrible, or, you know, he's just absolutely fearing for his life to kill someone like that, you know, which is strange, you know?
Yeah, well, it definitely strange.
Yes, it is.
But you're absolutely right, man. And I appreciate you coming on and sharing your stories. And thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I want to say thanks to you, Tony, and Brian for listening to my story as well, because I've never told anyone any of this before.
Absolutely, man. It was our pleasure.
Yeah, it definitely was our pleasure. It really was. And, you know, and really, the thing that as we wind this thing down, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking and listening and how you've changed and how your life has become different, and you have beautiful kids of your own now, and that's all fantastic. You know what it says is that redemption is possible. You know, the things that happen at one point doesn't make you that person the rest of your life. You know what I mean? It's a time, and it's a time to reflect on and grow from. And that's, you know, I just wanted to say that because I really did appreciate you coming on, and I'm glad that we did get this in. And it has been, you know, it seems like it's been a struggle, but maybe it was a struggle for the right reasons that it needed to be today, that things needed to come out today and have this conversation today, because it really was a good conversation, Dave. Really do appreciate your time and your effort and all the things that you've been working with us to get this done. We really appreciate it very much. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you as well. I know we're going back and forth with the thank yous. I just want to say to everyone listening to the show, what Tony and Brian do is extremely difficult. Recording all of this, taking all this in, this is the third time we've done this, and they're consistently been asking me to come on the show and tell my story. I think just because I'm in the military, that's it. That's how much they care. And they're working class people. They both still drive truck. My hat goes off to Tony and Brian.
All right. Well, that's the show, everybody. I really hope you enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, you know what to do. And Dad's going to tell you. Dad, what can they do?
They can share the show. Share it on Facebook. Share it on Twitter, Instagram, whatever platform you use, Parler, whether it's TikTok or whatever.
Yeah.
Share the show. Share it with your friends and family, and just get it out there. And we appreciate that.
Yeah, you said Parler, and some people are probably like, what the heck is Parler? Apparently, it's a new social media app. A lot of people have been asking me to join it, so I joined it. And from the looks of it, it's a bunch of conservatives retreating to a new app because they're not being censored there, which, you know, you take it away any way you want and stuff. But right now, censorship is very real on social media, and they're finding a home on Parler. It seems like a nice app. It looks like Facebook did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Before they had the Facebook Marketplace and all that stuff, it was just a social media platform. That's what this kind of looks like. Very clean looking, runs pretty smooth. I enjoy it. They're not even paying me to endorse it, but go ahead and check out Parler if you want. And if you do, give me a follow. Look me up, Tony Merkel. And I think my handle is @Merkification. Good luck spelling that. Bye, everybody.
Always did before, with a bulletproof screen on the hood of my truck and a Bradley on my back door. I wound her up and I shifted back, and I offered this prayer to my Lord. Said, God, get me back home to Houston alive. Early in the morning, I'm rolling fast. I'm on 9,000 gallons of hot test gas. Sergeant on the radio hollering at me, said, look out over here, there come a RPG. If I ever get home to Houston alive, and I won't drive a truck anymore. nights I had ice water in my veins. And I come over here 'cause I just didn't care.